So to ask the question, what do you do with your guilt, is simply to ask the question, how do you live with yourself? How do you live with your own knowledge of what you have done? That's where the link comes between guilt and guilt feeling.
Welcome to the Tuesday edition of Renewing Your Mind with R.C. Sproul. I'm Lee Webb. Guilt is objective. It's determined by a real analysis of what a person has done with respect to a law. R.C. puts it this way.
In a certain sense, all of us are under the law of God. So everything that the law says, it says to all of us. And what it says to us is that when we stand before the judgment seat of God, every mouth will be quiet. Every mouth will be stopped because under the judgment of the law of God, the whole world is guilty.
That's quite a verdict, isn't it? And all week here on Renewing Your Mind, we are featuring Dr. Sproul's series, Guilt and Forgiveness. And today he addresses the question, what do you do with your guilt?
In our last session, we looked at the question of guilt and of guilt feelings. And I introduced that theme by speaking of a pattern that I have in having discussions with people in the context of apologetics, wherein I will frequently say to people, what do you do with your guilt? The question, of course, is a complex question that any attorney would recognize because it assumes that there is an awareness of guilt that has to be dealt with. Well, let's look at that for a moment today. On the human level, what do? When we break rules and regulations or the laws that the government imposes upon us, and become guilty before the laws of men? What do we do about it? Well, there are several things that we attempt to do about that state of guilt, from the very simple transgression to those that are egregious and heinous. When I was a little boy and I went to elementary school, the teacher had rules and regulations. One of the rules was you weren't allowed to chew gum in class. Another rule was you weren't allowed to talk to your friends in the middle of class. And periodically, I broke those rules. And what happened if the teacher caught you breaking the rules was that she would administer, or he would administer, various forms of punishment, ranging from having to stand out in the hall, having to stay in after school, having to write papers, I will not chew gum in class again 100 times, or write it on the blackboard 100 times. And if the infraction was more severe, you were sent to the principal's office, which was a foreboding type of experience, and there were rules for that enterprise. If the first time you went to the principal's office for whatever infraction, you received a scolding from the principal, a minor punishment like staying after school or so on. And in addition, you had to affix your signature with this large paddle made of wood. And if you were sent there the next time and the principal said, what's your name? And you told him your name, and he looked on his paddle and saw your name written on the paddle, then the paddle was applied to a certain part of your anatomy. And so the various punishments were in an escalating pattern. And so what we did there was had a system of crime and punishment at a very simple level. Now, in the criminal justice system, we also have a crime and punishment program where there are all kinds of different levels of punishment that may be set forth for the violation of laws, leading up to incarceration and even beyond that to ultimately the application of the death penalty. Now, we often hear this expression in our culture by somebody who has broken the law, who's gotten into trouble, perhaps been arrested, convicted, and even sent to prison. And then at the conclusion of their sentence, they are released again into society, and you will hear this expression, that this person has paid their debt to society. Here, the whole concept of crime and punishment is articulated in the metaphorical language of economics, of indebtedness, whereby a debt is something that is owed and can be repaid. And so what we're trying to get at here with this whole question of dealing with guilt is, what can I do to make up for my guilt? What can I do to set the scales of justice back on an even plane? I can make restitution. I can endure certain punitive measures. Now, all of these things that we do at the human level of trying to deal with guilt that involve trying to make up for it or to take care of it are ways that we are trying to deal with the objective reality of the guilt. Now, it's important for us to understand that the guilt that we're trying to pay for or make up for is not thereby removed. We may even have a particular crime or misdemeanor or felony removed from our record, if possible. But that doesn't remove it from reality. It has happened. I remember when I got in trouble big time when I was in high school in the food line in the cafeteria. I got in a fist fight with a man that I shouldn't have. He was 6'7", and I was never so happy to see the dean come in and break up a fight because he saved me. But the dean was not happy about this occasion, and as a result of my breaking of the school rules, I was given a 3-day vacation from high school. And that was a very serious matter in those days, particularly when admission into college was quite a competitive thing. And it was not just something that would be easily assumed that you could get into school. And to have a suspension of that sort on your record was not good. And I remember having gone through the discipline of the 3-day suspension and having the occasion to have the supervising principal from the school district I had gone through 9th grade go to bat for me with the officials in the high school and took it on himself to request that this be taken off my record. Now, that was an act of pure mercy and pure grace on the part of the supervising principal, and he was able to accomplish that end, and this was removed from my high school transcript record, which helped me enormously in terms of my application for entrance to college. And so I still appreciate that, which was an act of mercy. But the removing of the record does not mean that my guilt was demolished. I still had done it, and it is part of the ultimate record of my life. I broke the rule. I paid the price. You know, I did the crime and did the time in this case and had it removed from my record, but my guilt was not erased from reality. Now, all of these are things that we do to deal with guilt at a human level. But the ultimate question that every human being faces is, what do you do with your guilt before God? Because the ultimate lawgiver is God Himself. And again, some people will say, I don't believe in God, I don't believe in His law, and I don't believe in His guilt. And let me just say, in terms of shorthand here, that your unbelief of God does not mean He does not exist. And if you don't believe in His law, it does not mean that there is no law. And if you don't care about what God does about your guilt, that doesn't deal with your guilt. What the Scriptures teach us is that God has published His law, and He has published it plainly. Now, I'm not talking about putting it on billboards or on national television, but we know that there is a record of the moral law of God contained in the written Scriptures. But you say to me, well, I've never, ever read the Bible, so I can't be held accountable for the law of God that's written down there. Or, I don't even know what the Ten Commandments are because I've never read that portion of the Bible. But the Scriptures go on to say that God has published His moral law not only in the tablets of stone that were delivered from Mount Sinai by Moses and became part of the inscripturated Bible, but, the Scriptures tell us, that God has written His law on the hearts of His creatures. Which is to say that every human being has an innate, inherent sense of what is right and what is wrong. And that God has published it in a place that you can't miss. Not in some obscure law book that is only found in a library secluded on some Ivy League campus, but He's published it in your heart. Now, when the Bible speaks of this heart at this point, what is obviously in view is the biblical idea of the conscience. That the conscience bears witness to this publication of the law of God in our hearts. Now, we'll come back to conscience later because that's a somewhat elusive thing. But just in passing, let me mention it, that according to the Scriptures, both Old and New Testament, God has revealed His law to you. And whether you acknowledge it, whether you like it, whether you admit to it, does not change the reality that you do have some grasp of what is right and what is wrong. This is the same kind of thing that the philosopher Immanuel Kant tried to demonstrate without appeals to the Bible or without appeals to religion, but simply with appeal to human consciousness and the universality of what Kant called the sense of the categorical imperative, and what Kant, in the sophisticated language of his critique, called a categorical imperative, he defined as a universal sense of oughtness that is possessed by every moral creature. And that includes me, and that includes you. And we also know that we all have moral obligations that we have not fulfilled. I often tell the story of a personal crisis or awareness in my own pilgrimage as a human being. I was a little boy during World War II, and at that time, my father was overseas fighting with the United States Army Air Corps. And as a little child, I was deprived of the presence of my dad at home, and I remember my mom working and every night typing on her typewriter her air letters to my dad. And when she was finished typing, she would pull me up into her lap, and she showed me two keys on her typewriter. One was the X and one was the O. And she would take my finger and show me where that key was, and she said, "Now you hit this a couple of times," and I would affix these X's and O's, and she explained that that was shorthand for love and kisses that I would send to my father. And I also remember, this is funny things that you recall from your youth, listening to the newscasts daily at noon and at 6 o'clock, where part of every daily newscast was a report on the latest casualties. And I hated that part of every day, because every day the radio reminded me of the vulnerable situation my father was in. Even as a little boy, I had some understanding that my father might not come back alive from this war. So I hated World War II. And again, as a little boy, I remember hearing about Adolf Hitler and Mussolini and Joseph Stalin and Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. And I remember going to my mother once quite earnestly and saying, "Mom, I have an idea." And she said, "What's that?" I said, "I would like to write a letter to Mr. Hitler and to Mr. Stalin and to Mr. Mussolini and these other people and ask them please to stop this war so that my daddy can come home." Because it was so plain to me that what these people were doing was wrong. And my mother said, "Son, you know, that's a good idea, but it's not really going to work." I said, "But why do they need to be hurting each other and killing each other? What good is there in that?" I was absolutely naive, had no understanding of geopolitics or anything that goes on in international conflicts. I was naively altruistic. I thought, I can't understand why human beings would settle their differences with violence. Then I got a little older, got to be 10 years old or so, and I would hear the big boys at the drugstore talk about all their sexual exploits with their girlfriends. And I thought it was the most disgusting thing I ever heard of. I couldn't believe that these guys would be interested in such things because they were not of any interest to me at age 10. And my resolve was, well, when I get to be 15 or 16, I'm not going to be interested in these sort of things. I didn't understand about adolescence and puberty and that kind of thing when I was 10. But here's what happened. I got older. I was involved in fist fights. That is, I started to use violence as a means of settling differences. Just like Mr. Hitler and Mr. Stalin and the rest. And as I grew older, I experienced the allurement of lust and that sort of thing. My behavioral patterns changed. But you know what else changed? My ethic. My moral expectations. Not simply for other people, but for myself. I realized that what I did was I adjusted my ideals downward. I adjusted my code of behavior downward. I adjusted my morality downward. Why? So that I could have an ethic I could live. That I could have a moral code that was within reach And secondly, a moral code that would give my conscience rest and peace and give me a good feeling about myself instead of a rotten feeling about myself. You see, I was going through a crisis of self-esteem because in the initial ventures of certain kinds of sinful activity, I was uncomfortable. And I was ashamed of myself. I was disappointed in myself. Do you see what I was doing? I was experiencing a new level, not only of guilt, but of guilt feelings. And I have since come to the conclusion that that transitional experience of growing from childhood through adolescence to adulthood was not an isolated experience in my own life. But I think everybody goes through something very much like that. So to ask the question, what do you do with your guilt, is simply to ask the question, how do you live with yourself? How do you live with your own knowledge of what you have done and of who you are? That's where the link comes between guilt and guilt feeling. Now, again, when we get to the highest level of law, we're talking about the law of God, about a law that is perfect, a law that is never arbitrary, a law that does not simply reflect the vested interests of a particular lobby group, but a law that reflects the perfect, holy, righteous character of God Himself. That's our problem. What do we do with our guilt before that law?
That's Dr. R.C. Sproul with a message from his series, Guilt and Forgiveness. And I hope you'll stay with us as R.C. returns in just a moment to conclude our study. All week here on Renewing Your Mind, we are looking at the reality of guilt that all of us face. And in this time of crisis, our neighbors are looking for answers to the big questions of life, questions of eternal significance. I think you'll appreciate having this series in your own library to help you answer questions like that, but also to share with family members or friends. So request the audio CDs of Guilt and Forgiveness when you contact us today with a donation of any amount. Our number is 800-435-4343. You can also find us online at renewingyourmind.org. And when you do contact us, we will send you a copy of Dr. Sproul's booklet, What Can I Do With My Guilt? The number again is 800-435-4343, and the web address, renewingyourmind.org. Let me mention a helpful feature that you'll find on our website as well as our mobile app. Once you complete your request, all of the audio messages will be available in your learning library online. That means you'll be able to listen while you wait for the CDs to arrive. You can also listen on the go when you access your learning library on the free Ligonier app. Well, as promised, here's Dr. Sproul with a final thought for us.
One of the things that we commonly do to deal with our guilt is to deny it. That's the most common response of human beings to the intrusion of the upsetting and disturbing awakening or consciousness of having violated the law. The first thing we try to do is to deny it. And we try to deny it to other people, and we try to deny it ourselves. And if that doesn't work, then the next step is that we try to justify it. We try to engage in what's called rationalization. There's a difference between being engaged in rational analysis and rationalization. rationalization is an illegitimate, spurious attempt to provide a sound, logical rationale for behavior that we know is wrong. But we do that, and we do it all the time. Again, both denial and rationalizations serve as a kind of protection or defense mechanism to shield us from the uncomfortable assault of a guilty conscience. We'll look at this more deeply in our next session.
Well, in ancient Greece, the word sin meant to miss the target. It was an archery term. And I hope you'll join us tomorrow as R.C. points out that missing the mark means something, something eternal. Join us for the message titled, Unable to Pay, here on Renewing Your Mind.